still rocking after all these years.
This is the story of my rock and roll butler.
This is it, the show that started it all. Often imitated, but never equal. From San Francisco, USA. Online since 2004.
Right.
It's the one and only rock and roll geek show. With the original rock and roll geek, Michael Butler.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. My name's Michael Butler. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. Today is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020, and it's 5:44 p.m. when I'm recording this intro. I just got off the phone with Tuck Smith, formerly the lead singer and songwriter of Biters. Now he's got a new record coming out called Tuck Smith and the Restless Hearts. I believe it's called Looking for Love, Ready for War. They're on the Motley Crue, Def Leppard's Joan Jett Stadium Tour, and I've been wanting to talk to him for a while. I've always been a huge Biters fan, and as a lot of you have as well. Well, we talked for about an hour and a half, and I got some information that I was not expecting it to be I was expecting to be interesting, but I was not expecting to get the information that I got. I thought it went really well, and he was a cool guy, and I learned a lot about the music business and some good stories from Tuck Smith. I hope you enjoyed this interview. Like I said, it went about an hour and a half, and it was good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was one of the more open conversations I've had with a musician, and I always love when somebody opens up and doesn't seem to be afraid to tell it like it really happened. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you, Tuck Smith, for coming on. I really appreciate it, man. And thank you for listening, friends. I'm going to shut up and I'm going to play a song. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play a song. Then we will go into the Tuck Smith interview. And then I'll close out the show with another song. Okay, so let's start off with a song from Biters. We'll do an old song to start off with. Let me pull up my iTunes. I'm going to play my favorite Biters tune. This song is called Indigo, and when he was on a label that they were going to record this album, and I played this song on a Rock and Roll Geek Show a long time ago, and I got told to please pull this song down because it wasn't released yet, and they didn't want it to be out yet. Well, I asked Tuck if it'd be what songs it would be okay to play, and he said, I don't care what you play. So that's what I'm going to play. I'm going to play you my favorite Biter song to start off. Then we'll go into the Tuck Smith interview, and then we'll close out with another song. Thank you so much for listening, friends. Please keep the donations coming. I'm not going to name all the donors tonight. I will do that on a show, probably do a show on Friday or Saturday, and I will thank everybody by name. But you know who you are. Please keep the donations coming. This is a value for value. So if you got any value out of this, please donate to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. Rockandrollgeek.com. There's a donate link and you can go there. And my livelihood depends on it, friends. So without your donations, this show will die a horrible, putrid, stench-filled death. And I probably will too. All right. I'm going to play a song and then we'll go right into the Tuck Smith interview. This song is called Indigo.
I'm ready to go.
Smith, thank you for coming on the Rock and Roll Geek Show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, buddy. Stoked to be here.
So where do you live? Where are you right now during the lockdown?
I'm in Atlanta.
Okay.
Like right east Atlanta, yep.
So do you live by yourself?
No, I live with my wife and my dog.
Oh, okay, good.
Where are you at?
I'm in San Francisco, but I have a place up in the mountains, so I escaped to the mountains while this bullshit's going on. I gotta go.
Right, like what part of the mountains?
You know where Trinity County is?
It's like Northern California?
Yeah, it's like you get to Redding. It's kind of like between Redding and Eureka.
Wow.
So it's like 4 hours north of San Francisco. I have a place in San Francisco is where I live, and I escaped.
Are you totally like sustainable out there right now, like mountain house?
Well, if I could hunt and fish better than I do, I'd be sustainable. But unfortunately, I'm not that great of a fisherman or a hunter. But
no, you're a rock and roller. Yeah,
I'm trying, but I'm not. If I had to depend on hunting and fishing, I would have survived in the last year on one squirrel and one fish. So,
oh my God! Wait, so how long ago have you caught a squirrel?
When squirrel season was happening, the beginning of this year, like 2 weeks before squirrel season, I shot one and cooked it up. It was actually the first squirrel I ever ate, and it was really good. You ever eat squirrel?
No, man. I mean, I'm from South. I grew up in Redneck, so I never ate squirrel.
I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, so I grew up in Redneckville, too.
Oh, yeah. But I never even had a squirrel. That's funny. Yeah,
it was surprisingly good, believe it or not.
Well, you got a wild caught squirrel out in the mountains. You're not fucking with like a city squirrel.
No, it tasted delicious. It was surviving, living off nothing but acorns.
you know what's crazy is you have my dream situation. I want to have like a self-sustainable house with well water and be in the middle of nowhere because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's scary when you really realize how dependent you are on the government and supply chain.
Please, man. In San Francisco, they're talking about shutting down the grocery stores. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Our infrastructure is just, we're different than we used to be. We're just completely reliable on the system.
Yeah.
And it's fucking scary, man.
I know it is. This place where I live up here, where I have a house up here in the mountains, I'm right off the river and it sucks water up from the river into these big tanks, and the tanks are what provides the water to the house. So I don't have to depend on the city for water. I do have to depend on for electricity, but it's not the normal California electrical company. It's a different company.
Well, the thing is, man, I would rather be able to have my own water resource than electricity.
Yeah.
I would rather be dependent because, so is this like a family house or?
Well, it's my wife and I got this house up here. We've been looking for a place for a long time. We finally found this place because I want to get out of San Francisco for good, but unfortunately I can't afford to because I have to work down in San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing to do up there. You got to go fully off the grid.
Yeah, and I'm in a couple bands down there, and so all the gigs are down there too. Well, there's no gigs anywhere now.
Yeah, you know.
But what are you gonna do?
Well, dude,
yeah, go ahead.
You're honestly living the dream, though, man.
Yeah.
That's something. I'd want chickens and pigs and well, maybe a couple goats, but yeah, you got it going on.
I do want some chickens. Once I'm up here full time, I'm gonna have some chickens. I just planted all these vegetables because I'm all freaked out about the world coming to an end. So I planted all these vegetables. I have to wait for like, 4 months for them to be ready to eat. But
well, the thing is, if the world doesn't end and we go back to normal, what else would you be doing right now?
Exactly. I'd be.
So it's not in vain.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get back. Do you make your living? Yeah, of course you do. All your money's made by touring and stuff, right?
Yeah, producing is a big income.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
catalog, publishing, songwriting for other people, all that shit. It's like a multifaceted thing.
So, You still have money coming in then.
Well, let me tell you this. No, not really. Not at all. I mean, merch sales have been really good because I've been promoting the shit out of some CDs. But I'll tell you what's really been really fucking helping me out, which was a surprise, is I've been doing these live streams.
Right, yeah.
And I didn't want to do them. It was never my personality. I thought it was always a little corny to kind of do it. Because I come from the school of rock and roll where you retain some kind of mystery.
Yeah.
You know, Bowie and all these people. But I started doing the live streams, and people have been tipping me, and it's really, really been supplementing my income for groceries and things like that. So super grateful that I'm able to do that, man.
Yeah, pretty much all my income now is from this podcast since this bullshit started. Listeners it's came crazy. Through and been showing their support, which I am so fucking grateful for. It's unbelievable.
I know, dude. It's weird. The fans and the supporters, they make all of it go round. All of it, so...
It's very so. Who do you write songs for that you're making money on?
It well, it's not just for, but let's say like I go write. I have a lot of songwriter buddies that I go write with. Like I'll go to LA and Nashville, and if I don't use them for me, I submit them and things like that. So I got a couple. Like my label has a bunch of up and coming bands that always need songs. So anything I kind of have that I don't use, I turn in. And you'll find out it's really strange, because the kind of the school I came from was just playing, you know, the dive bars and stuff.
Exactly.
And then you kind of start getting a peek behind the curtains, and you realize a lot of bands that get signed to kind of bigger labels and things, young bands, a lot of them, they don't have like a really core kind of great songwriter. And what they do is they just kind of dish them out to songwriters. And we know it in the pop world that none of the pop writers really write their stuff, but on a rock level, it's really the same thing. It's super bizarre.
Yeah. On mainstream, our major label rock bands, but there's a lot of them.
Not even major. Like you'd be surprised, like indie mid-level stuff, the songs are written by like songwriters.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Ginger Wildheart?
Of course.
Okay, good. That's good.
Dude, he offered to take biters on a Wildheart tour there. We just couldn't afford it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but it didn't add up.
That guy's probably one of the greatest songwriters of our generation.
I loved him. You know what I really liked? I don't think a lot of people like was that first Hey Hello record.
Both those Hey Hello records are good.
Yeah, the first one, dude, some of the hooks on there was like, put your fist in the air.
Yeah, that guy can write some catchy tunes. Well, you can write catchy tunes, too. I was going to say, you and Ginger, probably the two guys who write the super catchy tunes. You ever hear of a guy named Jeff Whalen?
Yeah, I wrote a song with him.
Oh, you did?
A year and a half ago.
Is it on the new record coming out?
No, it didn't make it. But you know, Sar, his band.
Produced by Rob Cavallo, that first record.
Well, that's one of the reasons why, which is fucking crazy. Like, everybody, I worked with Cavallo on this record.
Yeah.
I don't got to tell you his track record, but, you know, My Chemical Romance, some of, like, even the Goo Goo Doll stuff that was kind of power pop, you know, the big Green Day records. But that Sar record, I loved that record, and I was really excited working with him solely on the Sar record.
Exactly, me too. I would too. That's a near-perfect record.
You know what? When I was talking to Rob about that, I asked him a lot about that record because I think it's one of the coolest records he's done. And I said, why do you think that record popped off? It had the big budget. Uh-huh. I thought it had the songs. Cavallo said personally he thinks that lyrically, he didn't know if Jeff wore his heart on his sleeve enough for people to relate. But but I mean, that's a matter of opinion. He didn't know.
So maybe they thought it was a little too camp, a little too tongue-in-cheek and camp. Like,
I don't think it was the industry. I think the audience wasn't reacting.
How did you get... Go ahead.
No, I don't know. I just think that record is so good. It's one of my favorite
records.
Fantastic,
man. Did you have that record when... Did you just discover that record before you met Rob Cavallo, or did you already know of that record?
I already knew it, but when I knew I was going to start working with Rob, which we can get into that... later, but when I knew I was going to work with him, I started kind of listening to some of his production, because I've always made my own records with my buddy here in Atlanta, Dan Dixon. And so I never worked really with many other people. And I had my inhibitions about, I thought he was going to make me record stupid. And I didn't know him, man. I thought I was going to be auto-tuned and I thought my record might be fucked up. So I started listening to some of his records. I'm like, this guy's made some really cool sounding mainstream records. Because American Idiot, whether you like Green Day or not, that record
that is a fantastic record.
It sounds great.
Yeah. There's something about Rob Cavallo. That guy's probably one of the best producers in the world. Him, he's up there with Mutt Lange.
He's huge, yeah. huge, yeah. So then his discography, I realized that he did that fucking Tsar record.
Yeah. That's how I knew him. That's the first time I ever heard of Rob Cavallo was from that Tsar record.
Dude, I like their second record too. That's more lo-fi.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got some great tunes.
Did you hear Jeff Whalen's solo album that he put out last year?
Of course.
That album's fucking great, man.
Yeah, we wrote two songs together. Huh. And I fished him out. Like, it was hard kind of getting a hold of him. And he's never written to anybody. And I think he was reluctant. And like me, it's weird. I was a fanboy, and I'm asking him all these questions. I was like, oh, what was it like touring Marvelous 3? And oh, what was it like working with Rob? And tell me this. And he fucking, when the records like didn't do good for Jeff, he said he was like sitting on a park bench and just had an epiphany to be a librarian. And he just became a librarian. It was so fucking
Is that what he is now, a librarian?
I think so. But we hung out for a couple days, and I had a little Airbnb down in Silver Lake. And it was his old neighborhood, and he came down there and we hung out for a couple days.
That's where he lives, in Silver Lake.
Yeah, we wrote two really good tunes. They didn't make the record because I wrote like 40 songs, and you start getting everybody's opinion in the pot, which songs work. So still great songs, though.
So you got 40 songs written for this first album.
Dude, I've been metaphorically fucked in the ass by the music industry so bad.
Most people have, but I would like to hear how you got metaphorically fucked in the
ass.
But.
Dude, there's been so many points in my life where I have thought, man, I tried hard as I could. I can, on my deathbed, I'll know that I gave it my all. I'll just hang up my hat and call it a day. I can bow out gracefully. You know what I mean? And every time I go to do that, something happens. And so when Biters, which I can't really get into the reason why Biters had to break up, but
I'll tell you why. I heard that the Biters didn't want to put, or the record label, I don't know what the record label was, but Big, I don't know. I don't know what the record label. That doesn't not
Earache record.
Earache. Yeah. That's it. I heard they didn't want to do the next record, and they wouldn't let you do another record without. They didn't want to put out your record, and they wouldn't let you put out a record. So they kind of owned you.
That's not what happened. Right. No. It's such a long story, and before legal reasons, the lawsuit and stuff I went through with them ruined. It ruined. Never been so low, depressed, and defeated in my life. I just want to forget about them. But I will say, they would not let me go. And they would not let Biters do another record. They would not let me do another record. The only way for me to continue as a musician was to break Biters up.
You know, that is fucking so... I don't get it. Why record? That's not a different story than a lot of bands have gone through, and it's kind of a typical story with record labels. I don't get why they won't put out a record and won't let you do another record. It's just ridiculous to me.
Well, go ahead. Sorry.
It against everything you even started playing music for to begin with. When you start dealing with, oh no, I got to go hire lawyers, and it kind of just like, why did I even start playing?
Dude, I don't know anything about like business or stuff, and I don't like, I just want to make music and tour. But I will say this: Eric did a lot of good for me. I'm not hating on him, but by any means. But when the relationship went sour for numerous reasons. Numerous little things. And you know how relationships, they start to just kind of chip away, and before you know it, you're at a point of no return and you can never fix it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So me, I was trying to give them another Biters record to let me go. I said, give it. And then they kind of got into a pissing contest, and they were really, really spiteful. But they financially ruined me. The band had to break up, and not to mention the Biters internally, because of the record label and how ragged we were, and no money. We were fighting crazy, and I think everybody needed a break, and people wanted to move on. Oh. It was actually time for the band to move on, and everybody kind of started having different goals and, right. and different things. So everything happens for a reason.
How long does the record label own the Biters? I mean, like,
I don't want to get into the thing, but those records I put out on Earache, if a dimension portal opens up to another world tomorrow, they'll own them in that dimension.
So they own them in perpetuity, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I had to just say, take it right up
now, there. Now, what if you got the guy, I know you have the new band and everything and want that to be a success, but it, you know, Biters fans, Biters had a lot of huge fans. My friend Jasper and I saw you guys at South by Southwest when you were the
Heart. You come up Plan 9, Jasper?
Yeah, Jasper Plan 9, my buddy Jasper.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. I love Jasper. We saw you guys when you were the Heart Attacks, and then shortly after we saw you guys several times with the Biters. That's not I forgot what I was even saying now, but Biters have a lot of fans. You know, a lot of people love the Biters. And after the Tuck Smith and Restless Hearts, maybe years, and you decide you want to reform the Biters, just do a couple of Biters gigs. Could you rename the band, like, I don't know, the Bitters or something like that?
Well, the thing is, I can play out. So there's nothing against me playing out. I just can't release
a name under the Biters.
Any new music. If something happens and in 5 years, I told the guys, I said, we're going to do a reunion one day down the line. But I just got to put this shit and keep moving forward. But I will say that I don't know, man. I don't know what they're going to do. If my record does really well, they might re-release the Biter stuff again to get caught up the thing, which is fine. Because, man, at this point in my life and the shit I've dealt with, I can't hold a grudge long. And so, like, holding on to hate and that being vindictive and stuff, yeah, I just can't do it.
Sure.
I just had to move on. That was all. It sucked.
Is your wife – have you – how long have you been married?
A couple years.
Oh, okay. So was she with you when you were in the bot when you had Biters?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you produce that Ravagers record?
The one I just produced the new one. It hasn't come out yet.
Okay. And you produced
the new Ravagers record. Uh-huh. Fucking, you're gonna be blown away. Oh, I promise you.
Did you do a Wildlife record?
I did. I didn't do the one that came out last week, but I did the two before.
Yeah, the one before, Out on Your Block, that was my second favorite album of the year. That was a great album. The new one's fantastic. Have you heard the new one?
I did. I really like it. You know, we were talking about doing that record. I was going to produce it because it's not like there's any hard feelings, but they're on Little Steven's label.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, when you move, they have their own guys, their own producers. Right. And it does cost more for them to stay in Atlanta for 3 weeks. And so, you know, there's no hard feelings. They're still my friends. I support them. I love the record. Do I wish I could have did it? Yes.
So you do all of your records that you produce? You do them all in the same studio?
Well, I like using my engineer, Dan, because I feel like when you form bonds and friendships with people, it just comes out. And I can kind of say, do that thing to the vocals, Dan, that I want. And he knows automatically. So there's a camaraderie.
Yeah, you're a team.
Yeah, but, you know, if there was a band in L.A. I wanted to work with or something, and I know some people out there, like the guy who engineered my record, my solo record, Doug McKean, I would definitely make a record with him engineering if I was in L.A. So I just got to trust people that know the history of rock and roll and know the sounds.
So you make decent money producing?
Nobody's getting rich off of it, I can tell you that.
All right, but it's... something. So does your
well, if I produced like 4 or 5 EPs last year. Uh-huh. Like between Biters and this, like I did this band Prowess, uh-huh. I did band Fest Eddie, I did Ravagers, mm-hmm. I did I can't even remember all what I did. Mother.
Did you do Rambler?
No, I did not. Okay. Me and Chase, well, I love him, but I don't think we could work together, and he has his own idea. So
They have the Wildlife has a song about him on their new record.
Yeah, I know. It's funny.
Yeah, it's great.
It's so funny.
I just had him on the show last week. Dave.
Chase?
Dave, not Chase.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be kind of afraid to hang out with that Chase guy. He seems like a loose cannon. He seems like he might get into a bar fight or two.
No, dude, we grew up together, me and Chase. I love him. He's fine.
When we saw we saw
funniest motherfucker.
Yo, he's hilarious. When we saw Heart Attacks at South by Southwest, me and Jasper and I thought there was gonna be a couple of fights on stage. It was quite entertaining. Not the fights between band members, but a fight fights between band and audience.
Dude, when you're a teenager and you get signed to like Hellcat.
Oh, is that the label? Hellcat? Yeah.
Yeah, like we got signed by the guy from Rancid.
Yeah.
We were all teenagers. I'm telling you right now, your brain isn't fully developed, and I mean, what a bunch of fucking jackass knuckleheads.
Yeah, but it was fun, wasn't it? You always remember those fun times.
I don't remember shit, dude. I was fucking doing so much drugs and partying. I didn't do anything to accomplish rock and roll. And then when that band broke up and I started Biters, I felt like I was like making up for lost time. I was like punished. I was like, you know, when the Catholics like jack off or something and they feel bad and they whoop their own backside with a leather strap.
No, but okay, I get it. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah, to me, I was like punishing myself. I'm like, get better, get focused. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it's funny.
You still drink now or anything?
Yeah, I drink. Yeah. I just don't party like I used to. Super goal-oriented, man. I got obsessed with like, I don't know what happened. I just fucking got really kind of hyper-focused and obsessed with everything rock and roll musical.
So. Yeah, so you just buckled down and just started writing tunes. I'm assuming you wrote most of the tunes in Heart Attacks too, right? Or did you?
No. Actually, I think on that record, I've got like 4 or 5 songs writing credit, but it was all guitar. I was honestly sniffing so much cocaine and partying and worried about the lifestyle that I didn't really do shit or give a fuck about anything. It was fun and it was cool, but it was a complete waste of time as far as being creative or like learning your craft. Once I started Poison Arrows, me and the bass player Portwood from Heart Attacks, mm-hmm. we co-wrote all those songs, and he was actually a great writer, and now he's in a drug-induced coma for a while, and huh. woke up, and he can't walk. He's permanent. He's permanently brain damaged.
Holy shit. From doing drugs?
Of course.
Wow. So,
well, I mean, we can get into deaths and all the cautionary tale rock and roll, which sucks. But I don't want to.
Yeah.
But I will say, once I figured out what made bands great and just okay, once I learned that it was songs, it was like a door opened up. And then I realized that that's like a trade you kind of have to work on and figure out. It does come naturally, but I figure like hard work will beat talent any day. So I just got obsessed with it.
So So how did you start writing tunes? Did you just start playing tunes, or did you listen to songs and just like maybe listen to a T-Rex record or whatever, Sweet record or something, and try to like start playing those and then do a variation of it? How did you start coming up with catchy tunes?
I think that when Heart Attacks broke up due to drugs, jail, fuck it, mental institutions, like that just did not end well. It was so reckless and so self-destructive on everybody's part. I think I had like this really big chip on my shoulder to kind of prove everybody that I could do it myself. And so I kind of used that chip on my shoulder to say, I can do this. And I could already write like bodies of music. That was easy, but it was the lyrics that I didn't know how to write.
So you could write, so you could come up with catchy melodies, like vocal melodies, but just not
everything.
The lyrics.
I just couldn't come up with lyrics and the riffs. And so I started writing with my buddy Portwood, and I would come up with like choruses, like on Poison Arrows stuff. I would come up with like the chorus, but I had no confidence. I was kind of like just fucking shooting in the dark. And I feel like songwriting, if you really want to do it, you got to practice. You got to want to do it. And you got to want to do the stuff that isn't fun. Like writing lyrics isn't as fun as doing cool riffs.
So for a guy trying to tell a song, a guy who wants to write tunes, say he's in just like a cover band or whatever, not he wants to start writing an original band, you would just tell him, what would you tell him? Do you just write songs even if they suck and just keep writing tunes or to listen?
Yeah,
to-
you got it. Yeah, you. Well, here's the thing. There's like an X factor, I think, with songwriters. Like Mick Jagger could sing a lyric that somebody else could sing and would sound dumb and stupid, but he can make it cool. So there's like this X factor with certain people that just make stuff cool when they do it. Like, I don't think I could sing Bon Scott lyrics with a straight face.
Yeah, I get that.
But because they're kind of like, I honestly, if I sang I'm on the Highway to Hell, I would feel like a cheese ball. But he can do it. Yeah. So you got to find your own voice and make it authentic. And I think if you do it off, if you can make what you're saying authentic, I think that kind of shines through. But I don't, honestly, at the end of the day, I don't fucking know, man.
Do you, so you just sit down with the guitar and just come up with a tune?
I wish it was that easy. I will say that it never gets easier.
Because you came up with 40 songs for this new record. How long did it take you to write 40 tunes?
Dude, while I was on tour with Biters 2017, the tail end, you know, like December, yeah, so like right at 2018, I started writing, like laying in the tour bus. We were on tour with him, and I remember having demos and writing lyrics.
You were on tour with who?
Him.
Oh, you H-I-M, that guy.
Yeah.
Huh.
With Biters, yeah. Huge. That's, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 people.
Yeah, that guy's huge in overseas.
Yeah, I would be on a tour with him, Biters. There'd be no tour support, no press, no money, nothing, no support from the label at all. So you could see, like, how that started dwindling away, that relationship.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wrote so much, man, that I really think I burned, like, a some kind of rut in my neurological pathways. It really damaged me, using my brain that much. And I have a little home studio, and I would stay up here 60, 70 hours a week. And I would be so crazy on caffeine. I would just piss in jugs, man. At one point I probably had like 5 or 6 gallon jugs in the corner, just filled with piss. I didn't move. Cause I didn't want to fuck my shot up. I was like, if I'm whatever in the universe is giving me another shot to carry on after Biters and do a record with Cavallo and keep going, I've got to make sure that I have some really, really good, great, marketable rock and roll songs.
So when Biters,
I just went to town.
When Biters broke up, so you got it. You got Ricky Dover came in the band. I guess that was on the last.
I will say this, Mr. Butler, this is the most in-depth heart on my sleeve I've ever talked in an interview.
Well, I feel very honored.
I don't know why you're pulling this out of me.
How did you meet? So I guess you met Ricky when he was in the Tip, because you guys were going to play with we were going to produce the Tip. So how did you get?
Well,
Ricky?
I met him in the Booze. I met him in the Booze.
Oh, okay. I don't know that band. So that was his.
They're an Atlanta band. They're very kind of mod, late '60s, early '70s.
Is he from Atlanta?
No, he's in Nashville. But my friend Randy Michael, you know the band Mateel. She's a huge kind of indie. He produces and stuff in Atlanta, and he's been in a tons of bands. He played in Curtis Harding. But Ricky was in that band, The Booze, and the Biters and The Booze used to tour together in the same van in the early 2010s together.
Hmm. So
and then Ricky was in Birdwings as well.
So you got Ricky. Everything was not going good when you had Ricky in playing bass, because he was a fucking great guitar player, and then he moved to bass. So things were not going good when he was playing bass.
Well, we did a Blackberry Smoke tour in Europe. That's a good Biters. Uh-huh. Yeah, great tours. No thanks to fucking. But I will say, the bass player in Biters quit 3 weeks before a U.S. album release tour.
Was that your brother, or is your brother the drummer?
My brother was in the Biters before, and he left because he just didn't like touring, and I got my buddy Philip in. So the middle bass player quit like 3 weeks before a tour, and I was like, dude, if you want to quit, I understand this is not for everybody. It's a difficult lifestyle. Yeah, I'll never – if anybody ever wants to quit, like, you can't hold them against them if they're not happy and they want to have some sort of stability. But he dipped like 3 weeks before the tour and kind of left me with my finger in my ass, and I'm like, can you finish it? So I was like really desperate, and I called Ricky and I said, hey man, I know you're in Nashville and you know all these musicians. Do you know any bass players, touring bass players, that'll join the band for this tour? And he goes, yeah, I'll ask around, blah, 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 blah. And about 20 minutes later, he goes, actually, I've been playing bass quite a bit. And I'm not playing with a Tip anymore, so I'm down to give it a shot. Oh. I was like, really? All right, you're in.
Oh, so he quit the Tip before he joined you guys. I did not know that, huh? So
I don't know. I didn't ask. Went south. It was just so funny how he goes, "Yeah, I'll be, keep an eye out for musicians." And then literally 20 minutes later, he's like, "Actually, I've been playing bass quite a bit lately."
Oh, that's good. So things were not going good when he was in the band. Did you guys make any? I mean, you got on these good tours. Were you getting paid well enough?
No, not in Europe. No.
Huh.
No, we were touring in the U.S. and making enough money to fund the European tours. I was putting on personal credit cards $10,000 a tour. We would go about $10,000 to $18,000 in debt on every European tour, and we would tour the States to pay back the debt for Europe.
Because a lot of bands, you know, like there's been, I don't know if you know who Dan Baird is, but he's he was in Georgia Satellites, and
yeah.
He stopped touring now. But anyway, bands like that do well in Europe, and they just play Europe and play Europe, and they make their money just by touring Europe. So they get all the monies in Europe.
Well, yes, you can make money in Europe, but the thing is, you've got to eat shit for a little bit, right? So you got to do the support tours, which you're not getting paid.
Support tours on. You make did Earache take merch money too?
No, but they charge astronomical amounts for wholesale.
So you had to go through Earache to get merch made, like T-shirts.
Well, for your CDs.
CDs.
No, T-shirts.
Yeah.
So T-shirts, I would have to hire a company over there to front us, right?
Uh-huh.
But think about this: you're paying $750 for a shirt. You sell them for $20. You give the venues a cut. Then you pay your merch person. Then you got like
because of the level of venues, you had to pay venues for merch. Because we're on the punk rock level, the venues don't want to take.
And a lot of Live Nation places, even they see in Europe, it's different. You can have a 200, 300 cap club that's Live Nation style.
Uh huh. Yeah.
That's corporate.
Right.
So we would make money on merch a lot, and then it would go back because you got to think. The guy like you're talking about, he probably has his own gear over there. He's toured enough to have his own gear. And he probably has his markets where he can get a great guarantee. But you start adding up plane tickets. You got $5,000 to $7,000 a plane ticket. You got a couple $1,000s in rental gear. You got to rent all different stuff. Then you got to have a vehicle. You got to have a driver. If you're touring Europe, you got to have a bilingual guy or whatever. So you need at least two crew. And then you got to have a place for seven people to sleep every night. And so that shit adds up super quick, man.
Yeah. It probably costs more to be on bigger tours too, I guess.
Way more. And the sleep deprivations is absolutely unreal because they're all in a tour bus and you're like in a little splinter van.
Right, yeah.
And so you can't drive all night. So a lot of those European tours, like we did Danko Jones, we did the Kerrang! Sum 41 tour, we did Blackberry Smoke, we did him. All those kind of tours, man, I was sleeping about 3 hours a night and it fucks with you so bad. And you just fight with everybody and you're delirious and you're just dumb as fuck and you don't know what you're doing and you're sick the whole time. But it was all to kind of build and blaze a trail. It's almost like Vikings. You go over there and you have to go fucking pillage for a while and set up your kingdom. And so that's what I was trying to do. And I was definitely going into debt really bad.
Yeah. So Biters break up, or you kill the Biters due to whatever legal reasons. And how long before you started working on? I'm assuming you just said, "Fuck it, I'm going solo. I'm going to start writing tunes now." But how long? How long before the wheels came in motion business wise for Tuck Smith and the Restless Hearts?
Well, I had a bunch of. I was meeting with Cavallo a bunch.
Oh, how'd you meet him? How did that come about?
You want to hear a crazy small story? It's fucking crazy. So my manager lives in LA. This is like a weird conspiracy thing. My manager lives in LA and he was at a golf course.
Uh-huh.
And then in the locker room, Rob Cavallo was in there like butt naked out of the shower. And my manager's like, "Rob Cavallo?" And he's like, "Yeah." He goes, "Oh, I'm John Greenberg. You might not know me, but we have a lot of mutuals." And he's like, "You producing any rock bands?" And he goes, "No, but I'm really looking for somebody to produce that's rock and roll. You know anybody?"
Huh.
My manager goes, "I got the perfect guy."
You know what that's called? That's The Secret.
Oh, yeah, dude. I just fucking did The Secret. Law of Attraction, which I practice that. You talk about visualization every single night.
Huh.
I've always wanted to work with Rob, but I do know that you know, and then my manager just got Rob's number and bothered the fuck out of Rob until he agreed to meet me.
So let me interrupt. I'm sorry to interrupt. Isn't he an expensive producer?
Yes.
I mean, you maxed out your credit cards paying for the biters. How do you afford him?
Well, here, I would max out my credit cards with the biters, and then we would tour the U.S. and pay it back over time. So, and when I mean maxed out, I mean, hold on one second. Let me crack a beer. Since we're going deep.
Yeah, okay. I'll join you. I'll crack one, too.
I'm cracking a beer.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Dos Equis. But listen.
Okay. I'm drinking a Tecate, so we're...
This is the deepest I've ever went. This information.
Okay, good.
I've never talked.
Good. That's what I like.
So with Cavallo, I mean, if you're putting $10,000 on your credit card, you can pay that back in a couple, 6 months, 8 months on tour.
Oh, you can. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Well, right. I mean, biters toured a lot.
Yeah.
So, anyways, so Rob decided to meet me. But what was weird is, and Rob told my manager he didn't know who the biters were and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But then as we recorded, because these people are so secretive, it's like this own elite thing. Rob would talk about how Billy Joe from Green Day would come into the studio wearing biter shirts all the time. Mm, okay. And I know that my friend Todd Youth, when we were touring with D-Generation.
May he rest in peace.
Yeah, I love Todd. Good buddy. He gave Cavallo in like 2012 or 13 all chewed up biters record, and the next day we played San Francisco. Warner Brothers called Matt Gabbs's phone and asked us to come to the office in LA.
Huh.
And we couldn't make it. And the next thing you know, my manager ahead of the time got into it and fucked it all up. So I knew Cavallo was aware of the biters, and through Billy Joe and through Todd Youth and some other people, but he acted like he didn't know till later on. So he had heard of the biters. So it's this really weird coincidence and a long time coming kind of thing.
So, okay. So your manager meets him, and did you flew out to LA to meet with Rob Cavallo?
So when we do the behind the music, you're definitely going to be the interview.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Good. All right.
I'll hold you to that.
So
let's hope the record is a huge success so you get it behind the music.
I hope so, man. I'm set up for it. So so you got to think about this. Lawsuit with Earache. I'm still going through the lawsuit after the biters is done.
Hmm.
And I'm stacked with fucking lawyer's bills. Just completely shattered.
Uh-huh.
They're calling me every week. My manager is like, we're going to figure this out. He's a super great, positive guy. And Cavallo wants to meet me while I'm still in this lawsuit. I'm flat broke, and I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life because I'm just so hopeless. And you know when you get depressed in weird situations, you can't really think clearly because you're just stuck in your own hole.
It turns into a spiral.
I was definitely way, 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 way down the rabbit hole. So – my manager said, Cavallo wants to meet you. And I'm like, well, I don't have any money. I have nothing going on. And he goes, you got your credit card? I said, yeah. So I just put more of it on the fucking credit card and went out to LA.
So you put plane ticket on the credit card, not production.
And an Airbnb.
Okay. You put your travel.
No, this is early. I developed my relationship with Rob for months, man. It didn't happen immediately. This is the first time I ever met him. He didn't hear songs. And I went, this is fucking crazy.
How did the first meeting go? What was the very first sentence that was said?
You want to know?
Yeah.
It's like, I flew into LA, and I set up a couple writing sessions with people I knew. One of them was my buddy Keith Nelson from Buck Cherry, which he quit Buck Cherry, but he's, dude, I know.
He writes for a lot of people.
I know that people say talk shit on Buck Cherry, but Keith is amazing. He's got a great taste in music and a great ear. So he's the real deal. So I set up some writing with him and a couple other people I knew just to make the trip worthwhile, right? Just so I didn't go out there because
– yeah.
So
and you can write off that plane ticket too if you do your taxes.
Yeah. So I'm trying to stay positive and trying to enjoy it because L.A. is super inspiring. So we go to L.A. I meet my manager in front of Capitol Records, the big stacked building, the famous one.
Yeah.
It's like 2 p.m. We go up the fucking elevator where the Beatles
meeting Rob Cavallo at Capitol Records?
Yes.
I wonder why he said, did he call the meeting there? Does he work for Capitol? Is he at an office in Capitol?
He has a subsidiary label there, yeah.
Oh, so he has an office there, huh? How about that?
Yeah, he has a record label there.
And what's his label called?
I don't fucking know. 507 or something. Okay. I don't fucking know. It's a subsidiary of Capitol. So we go way high up to his office, and you know, he's got a beautiful 21-year-old assistant, Danny Pincus, which worked on the record. And you walk into his office, and there's a Green Day American Idiot plaque with records on the wall, but it's so many gold records or whatever, platinum, that it takes up the whole fucking wall.
Just a Green
like,
Day.
Dude, it's just American Idiot. It's like there's 12 or 15 records inside the plaque. It covers a whole wall. You know what I mean? Because they sold like 12 million copies or something. And there's Mike Chemical. There's all these hit records and stuff. And he comes in there. And I just remember it was so clean and so nice. And I'm wearing like this ratted out like sweet shirt and some dirty Converse. And I'm like, God, I'm like such a –
That would impress him, I would imagine.
Yeah, but it just made me feel so dirty. So we just sat down and we talked about what was going on with Biters. And he was just kind of picking my brain and asking me things. And they ordered lunch catered from – there's a restaurant inside Capitol that makes stuff.
You got a good lunch out of it. Good.
Yeah, well, I was nervous, man, because I'm like, fuck, because I don't – but I didn't have my heart set on it. So we talked for like 2 hours that day in his office just about stuff. And my manager was talking
what
stuff.
Kind
and,
of you stuff? Know, when, what kind of stuff?
My manager and other like record people, they always like do pissing contests. Oh, I used to work with Steven Tyler and then Duff McKagan. Oh,
so
I know
you got
him.
the bragging of the track records.
That's what they do.
Start, yeah.
They do that, and I'm sitting there. I was talking about, you know, I love Cheap Trick and this and these records, and he hasn't heard any songs, any demos. He supposedly hasn't heard Biters before.
But he was bullshitting you.
I guess. I mean, you got to think, if you're that much of a big producer, I would be guarded too.
He's got.
Right?
He's playing it cool.
He's guarded. So we talked for a while. And nothing happens. And he's like, okay, well, it was nice meeting you. We leave, right? So we go out to the parking lot, and in front of Capitol, I made my manager take a picture of me out in front. It's on my Instagram. And I'm like standing in front of Capitol Records. And I told my manager, I said, get a picture of me because I'm never coming back here. I said, he doesn't like me, man. He doesn't give a shit about me. It was great to meet him. I really want to make a record with him, but I just could tell he wasn't vibing with me. And it just, whatever, right? I wanted to go faster and be like, let's get in here and hear demos and stuff. So I kind of left disheartened, but I didn't have my hopes up too high because, you know, that's a long shot, right?
Yeah.
To do a record with him. So I go to my buddy.
That's a little bit of a mind fuck by a producer too, you know, to put a guy through that, but go ahead.
Well, he wasn't being rude or anything. Yeah, he just met with me.
I know. Yeah.
And I didn't know what was going to expect to happen.
Well, go ahead.
He didn't know that I just fucking rented an Airbnb and a plane ticket and went out there. It was a huge thing to me. It was a regular Tuesday to him.
Yeah, he thought you were just like, yeah, go ahead.
So am I boring you with the story?
Oh, absolutely not. This is what I'm into. I'm way into this shit.
So I tell my manager, he's the nicest guy. He's been with me through Biters. He's helped me through everything. I said, John, I really appreciate you so much, man. You stuck with me through this whole lawsuit. And you helped me meet with Cavallo, but he doesn't like me. I said, he's not going to call me. I'm going to try to, I think we should go with plan B. And my manager goes, Tuck, are you fucking kidding me, dude? He goes, you know how busy he is? He said, you know how many people have probably called him when he was in that meeting? He didn't answer. That man just met you for 2 fucking hours.
Yeah, he gave you two hours. That's pretty impressive.
My manager said, if he didn't want to meet with you, he would have his assistant come in there and say, you have a meeting. You need to go. He goes, just wait. I don't fucking know because I don't play games like that. So I went to my buddy Keith. We're riding. And I'm like, oh, dude, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm fucked. My band's broke up. I'm fucking in debt with a lawsuit. You know, I'm just whining and complaining. Uh-huh. My Keith's like, buddy, let's just write some songs and keep our head down and move forward. And as we're in the writing session, Rob texts me and goes, hey, man, can you come over to my house about 9 or 9:30 tonight and bring your guitar? I want you to hear some of your songs.
Bring your guitar. I want you to hear some of your songs. So I want you to sit in front of me and play like a dancing bear.
So the only thing, and I'm like, holy shit. But I'm not nervous because I've met these people.
What have you got to lose?
Yeah, but like I do want to do this. I really, it was always been a dream of mine to make a record with him. So you got to think about me. From Atlanta, what I've done, where I just came from, I go to Sherman Oaks and pull up to this fucking, I don't even know how much the house costs, dude.
Yeah, it's a nice
place. I'm in like my little rental, $65 a day rental kit.
Right, yeah, I get it.
And there's a code to get in.
Does he have a butler?
And Mercedes and shit. No, he's super down earth, dude. He's awesome. He's the coolest, one of the coolest guys, Kabbalah. And I go to his house.
How great would it be if he had slaves?
No, that would not be great.
Go ahead.
So I go in there and I got my fucking, you know, little guitar.
You brought an acoustic or what?
I brought it to write. Yeah, I brought it to write acoustic. I fly with it. It got smashed about a year later in the airport, American Airlines. But, you know, it was like a 70s Alvarez. I don't fucking know. So we go into his house and he's like, hey, how you doing? Come on in. It's huge.
Did you at any point think, is this guy gay? Is he hitting on me?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good.
Nice. And you can tell he's so fucking smart that you can't read him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's genius level.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
So I'm like, does this guy think I'm cool or think I'm a fucking bitch?
I would have been shaken. Was your manager with you?
No.
You're by yourself.
Yeah. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah,
it's fine.
I've been shitting my pants.
No, so it was just weird, the setting. If he would have came to like a show and saw me play like a rock and roll show where, you know, where people are crazy, he'd be in my element. Be like, yeah.
Right.
But like,
on your
I'm
turf.
In his house. Yeah, but I'm on his turf. And I just remember like his son is watching TV on like the nicest, most, dude, I don't even know how much the couch costs. Uh-huh, he's got a dead Kennedy shirt on.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? So his wife's in there. She's so fucking nice. And, he's like, well, come on, let's go in this back room. And so I get into the back room, this little, dude, it's so fucking small, like a listening room. You could tell they just moved into the house. Nothing was in there. Like he had no pro. I said, do you have Pro Tools in here? Do you have stuff? He goes, oh, I don't run Pro Tools. I don't do that. I don't have anything.
He does all analog?
Dude, no.
Okay.
He just
doesn't have
school.
That at his house.
No, he don't do it. He's just a producer, not an engineer.
Ah, got it.
So I literally, we talked for a second, and he made me some peppermint tea. It was so weird.
Peppermint tea, Tuck?
Well, I wanted caffeine, so yes. He goes, oh, I'll get you the good shit, the P&G tea. So we sit down, and he's being super cool, and I just get my guitar, and he goes, all right, so play me some songs.
Huh. See? Were you shaking or anything? You were just totally cool with it?
I'm not shaking, but I'm also like, when it goes in the fight or flight, I usually fight.
Yeah.
So I'm fine. I'm just so used to being under pressure and things.
Wow,
and I'm
that's like
fuck it.
Unbelievable. Go ahead. I'm loving this story.
Well, this is before I was really like doing a lot of acoustic shows and things like that. So I wasn't like really prepared to like sit down with acoustic and play, which is what I do all the time writing. So I said, well, Rob, I'm going to kind of play these kind of in a low key. So I'm not like screaming. It's like 10 o'clock at night. He's got kids and shit.
Now, were these new songs you played him or old songs? Biter's tunes?
No biters. No. He
all
wanted to hear what song. I got.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Because he goes, what you got? Let me hear your songs. No demos, which I had demos and stuff. So this motherfucker says, do this. So you know what the first song I played him was?
Was it a cover?
No, it was What Kind of Love.
Okay, all right.
No, he only wanted to hear originals. He didn't want to hear my skill.
Yeah.
He wanted to hear me if I had tunes.
Huh. So the first single is what you play him.
I played him What Kind of Love on acoustic. And he goes, man, that's really good. That's like Mellencamp.
Wow. I was like, cool. That's a compliment. Like,
for me, because I love Mellencamp. That's what
hell
I was
yeah.
To
fuck yeah,
I
man.
I was trying to do Mellencamp meets like Cheap Trick Joan Jett.
Uh-huh.
So he goes, wow, that's great. He goes, play it again. Played it again. He goes, I really like that.
And it's
goes,
a simple song, just three chords.
Well, that's what he wants.
Uh-huh.
That's what they're looking for. So I, he goes, do me a favor. I want right now off the top of your head, I want you to play it. But when you get to the chorus, I want you to come up with a different chorus.
Huh, what?
So no, but I do this all the time. And so I get to a part and I wrote maybe even a better chorus than the one we have now.
So wait a minute. So what was the original chorus? Was the original chorus What Kind of Love?
Yeah, I used the same words, but I came up on the spot a different melody and different chords.
Hmm.
I went to an E minor. I remember what I did. And he goes, wow, that's really good. Now can you play it in 6/8 time?
Did you know what 6/8 time was?
Yeah, because I programmed drums all day on Pro Tools. Oh, okay. Pretty strict.
All right.
So I played it in 6/8 time. He goes, nice. You can just do that?
Dude's putting you through a test, man.
Yeah, yeah. And then he goes, now play it again and do a different chorus, but I want you to go to this chord.
What the hell?
And so I did it, and it sounded really good, but I was like in a moment, I was dialed into some kind of frequency. I felt so good because I was in my wheelhouse.
Oh, you must have came out of there feeling like, man, I'm a fucking badass.
I don't know what I felt like. Because you got to understand, sitting on a chair with a guitar is where hunched over inside of myself is probably like where I spend the majority of my time.
He told you to do the chorus different the third time. So what did you do the third time with the chorus?
He wanted me to go to a different chord.
A different chord. Okay. So what?
Yeah, a different chord. I can't remember. And then he goes, cool, what else you got? I played him another song. And he goes, fuck, that's really good. He said, that's like Because the Night, Patti Smith.
What
I said,
song
I know.
Was it?
It didn't make the record. So I don't know why. I can get into that later. But he said, play it again.
So it was like Because the Night. It was more of a ballad?
No, I smashed it out. Like it was like same kind of feel, the same kind of feeling of that song. Right. But I made it. So it's still a really good song.
It's kind of dark, but it was kind of dark a little bit.
Yeah, I just submitted it for the Bill and Ted movie that's coming out.
Huh.
So hopefully it gets in the soundtrack. So then he said, what else you got? Well, the thing is, I had written like 12 songs.
Uh-huh. You only had 12 at this point, okay?
I think, and I played him Looking for Love, Ready for War. I played him a couple other songs, and he goes, these are really great. He goes, I really like the chords that you're using.
And what were the chords? They were just open chords?
No, they're just like stuff that you would write songs
with. It's like D, like an open D or an open G or a...
I think he meant the progressions. I think he meant that I wasn't really worried about... At the root of it, you could strip it back and just sit at a campfire.
Were they all like in a box, progressions, like the pop, like the three chord progressions?
Three and four, but like if you break down any of the great songs, they're all going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that he liked is that I could sit down at a campfire or at a party and you could sing these songs.
He wanted to hear them stripped down, which is pretty much genius of a producer to think
yes. About that. You know what it reminded me of is when Jimmy Iovine asked Tom Petty to play songs and he said he played them Refugee on acoustic and then he played them Here Comes My Girl, and he goes, that's it, we got the record. That's it.
Yeah.
So, which I'm not comparing myself to him. I'm just saying it was that situation where he wanted to hear it. So then he goes, you have your notebook? He goes, let's write. I said, well, I kind of wanted to make this feel like a Fleetwood Mac part. He goes, you like Fleetwood Mac? I said, I'm a really big fan of Lindsey Buckingham's guitar playing.
Yeah, of course.
So he goes, cool. I said, well, let's write a song using the same chords of Fleetwood Mac. And I think he played You Can Go Your Own Way, like the chords. Mm-hmm. And he goes, can you come up with something over that? And I said, tell me a title.
Also, he had a guitar in his hand, too.
Yes, yes. And he could learn everything because he's a genius level.
Did he have acoustic or electric or what?
Yeah, he had acoustic. He had acoustic and he picked out the same chord progression.
What kind of guitar was it?
I don't fucking know. Okay. Probably the same one that was used on Tommy Your Life.
Of antique Martin, worth $100,000.
I don't know. Yeah, but he doesn't act like that. He's seriously down to earth.
Huh.
So he started playing the chord progression to like this Fleetwood Mac song.
To Go Your Own Way.
I don't know, some song like that. I can't remember. And he goes, let's write a song to it. Hum. So I just started humming. He goes, that's good. Go to that chord. And he goes, where is your notebook? And I said, I always like this title. And the title was "The Whole World's Going Crazy, But At Least I Got You, Baby." Uh-huh. And I said, I think that's like super long and cool. He goes, let's do it. So we sat there, and over the chords, I wrote this really big fucking chorus over the chords on the spot to him. And it was really good. And he's like, holy shit, this fucking rock. This is fucking awesome. So we hung out, and he goes, well, this is great.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hold on one second.
Yeah. Tuck put me on hold.
Sorry. Okay. I got a text for you. So the first time went really good. I just kind of played him songs, not in full voice, just kind of like showing him the things, and he really liked it. And then I went home riding high, and he talked to my manager, and he's like, he texts us on thread. He goes, I really like Tuck a lot. He's got great songs. let's keep moving forward.
You had to have, when you heard that, you must have said, I'm a fucking bad motherfucker.
No. It was validating to me because I worked so hard. And to have somebody like him who's worked on big records say, your songs are great. It made me feel good because I worked so hard.
Hell yeah.
trying to keep them simple.
How long were you at Rob Cavallo's house?
A couple hours. And so I went home and I kept writing and I demoed out the song we worked on. And I had a reason to be like deadlines, right? It's good to have deadlines and good to have a reason to be inspired.
So you demoed the song that was over a Fleetwood Mac chords.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What song did that become?
It didn't make the record because I wrote stronger ones in the end. So I will say that it's still good. It might be on the next record. But so I came back to Rob's a couple months later. And I played him my demos. And then he's like, oh, this is great. This is fucking great. But he did say, he goes, you know, some of the stuff you play, he goes, play me your songs again. He goes, some of the stuff sounds like 80s rock and some of it sounds like Oasis. So I'm confused. Uh-huh. I said, because you're hearing them on acoustic, let me play you for the demos. So when I played him the demos that he could kind of hear, like on What Kind of Love, the demo is really close structurally and everything of what's going on to the record.
Right.
Not much is different. So it's the big hand claps, the big drum beat. And so he did that. And then I went out to eat with him and his wife and their stylist friend at this diner. And we just hung out. I told stories about living in the South and they just fucking loved it. And his wife said, I reminded her of one of the Tiger Beat models from the 70s. And
she had those silver
walls. So I don't think that hurt my cold.
Wow. What diner? I mean, they took you out to eat to a diner?
A nice one. It's the nice one down there in it's a famous one.
Okay.
The deli or something. Okay. Like something.
All right.
I can't remember.
So his wife loved you too. She thought you were cute.
She
had a cool haircut.
Yeah, she just said I look like the classic like 70s teen beat kind of thing.
Thank God you got a haircut before you headed out to LA.
Yeah, I know. So it was really good, and I was super stoked. And he was so kind and professional and just cool. I don't know.
So what ended up – so how did he end up coming to do the record when you had no budget?
So then I went home and wrote some more. And then he goes, I think we have a record, Tuck. I want to make a record with you.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great. Great compliment.
Yeah, but it took, I mean, this was like 6 months uh-huh. going back and forth. Mm-hmm. He's a big deal. He hasn't made a rock and roll record in a while. So for him, it's a big thing.
What was the last rock record he did?
I had a big Shinedown record.
I don't know that band.
So I went out there. I finally got out of the Earache deal. It took me so fucking long. And so when I finally got out of that, I said, I'm out. He goes, well, let's make a record.
He was waiting for you to be he was waiting for you to be legally out of jail.
I couldn't really do anything. He knew I was going to get out of it.
Okay.
But so his label doesn't sign rock stuff. They're not interested in taking a risk. Uh-huh. So my manager's like, let's do this. So I went and met Doug McKean, the guy who did the engineer. We went to a little listening room and we played all of my demos and he made notes on all the songs. this one's great. This one's good. We're going to cut this. We're going to cut this. And then the next day we went back through them again and listened to them. And at this point I had probably like 25 songs. I hadn't did any co-writes really. Right. I'm trying to make this.
I'm listening. Yeah. I'm into it.
I don't know if this interview's dragging on.
No, this is, I'm captivated. Keep going.
Okay. So I went back out there a couple times and it was all on my credit card. I was just taking a risk. You got to take chances on yourself. You know what I mean? If you believe in it, you just got to fucking take the leap.
So he's not on board yet though. Cause you don't, when he said, I want to make a record with you, did he say, how are you going to pay for this record, Tom?
No. Cause we're about to get there. So he says, I got songs. He goes, I want to make a record. Cause this is going to be a lot of fun and you got great songs. And I don't like how labels treat artists.
I feel like
there's an audience for what you're doing that's asleep, and we really need authentic artists, because if you don't know me and you just look at a picture or something, you might think I'm just a fucking fake. But when he hung out with me, he's like, fuck, you really are kind of knowledgeable about this rock and roll, about rock and roll, and you really believe it. So he was like, I'm all in. So then the next thing was, go get a record deal.
That's what he said. Go get a record deal, but I'm all in once you get a budget.
Yes. Huh. Well, then you want to talk about a whole other mountain.
Yeah. How does a guy in a failed pop punk band or whatever, a failed underground rock band, get a record deal?
Sorry, man. Just call me. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Everybody's calling right now.
We won't go too much longer, about 20
no,
minutes.
No, it's fine. I like telling the story. It's fucking crazy. All right, so.
So how do you get a record deal? Because that's easier said than done.
I thought, being a little bit naive, that just because Cavallo had signed on, I was going to be able to get the cream of the crop.
Right, yeah. It's like, I got Jim Carrey to sign on to do my movie. You want to pay for it?
Boy, was I wrong. Boy, was I wrong.
So what do you do? Call up every record label and say, I got Rob Cavallo on board. You want to?
So my manager knows a lot of people from being in the industry.
Okay, he did the work.
So we put together about 5 or 6 songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a couple of live pictures and photos from Biters.
Right.
And he sent out, dude, it was probably 40 to 50 labels, from major labels to indie labels that might be able to cough up enough to do the record. Hold on 1 second.
Right, who's texting you?
A couple different people.
Okay.
My manager just texted. It's fine. So I had like a Dropbox link with all my home demos. And I was going back and forth to writing trips. And then during this time, I wrote with a bunch of great writers. I wrote with Butch Walker, which is my buddy. I wrote with Yeah, we live in L.A., but Chris Seyfried, which works for a lot of stuff. I was writing with Keith and a couple other people just to try to see if I could get any tracks. Well, every single label was turning me down. This is cool. I just don't think there's a market for it.
Rock's not selling right now.
Rock's not selling at all. This is cool. So I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but we went to Interscope, which Rob has a great relationship with, and my manager and Rob Cavallo went to have a meeting at Interscope together. Brought the demos. Oh, I also went to Sony Red, and they were super hot about it. My buddy Don Robertson, and he flew to New York and made a presentation about it. And they said, "We don't want bands like this. We want bands like Lovely the Band. We want pop stuff. We're not going to do rock like this." So I had people rooting for me, but I couldn't get a catch a break. And this is a small story you might like. They went into Interscope and they played him some of the demos. And Rob goes, I can blow this up. And the guy goes, this is super cool. This has kind of got an American rock vibe. I really like this. And they said, yeah, you know, we have the Struts on here and they're doing really good. And we just did their record. We've made it 3 different tries to get it right and blah, blah, blah. And the A&R guy said to Cavallo, right there, he said, so Rob, when you do this record, are you going to add any elements of trap or hip hop drums to it?
Brother.
Because listen, because you know why? Because trap and hip hop do really good on quarterly revenue, and they stream the best. So we've been making our rock bands put elements of trap in.
Oh, is that what the Struts do?
I don't know. So
I don't even know what trap is.
Cavallo looks at my manager and goes, have you just heard what we played you? Like, how could you even fathom to think to put trap or hip hop beats into this? And they said, well, no thanks, got up and walked out.
Let me ask you this, if I can interrupt. If they would have said, we'll sign you if you'll put some trap and hip hop beats into this, would you have done it?
Fuck no. And neither would Cavallo.
Okay, good.
Cavallo likes rock and roll, dude. He's honestly not, his brain doesn't think like that. He doesn't cater to radio. He doesn't cater to labels. He doesn't cater to trends. I can attest to it.
You know, I don't want to be negative, but that guy who at Interscope that they met with, he's a douchebag.
I don't know, dude. I'm not trying to throw them under the bus, but anyways, I don't know. It was really weird. And then I realized that I'd gotten in way over my head. I was like, fuck. So we had a couple of mid-level offers, but you know, Cavallo's not, I don't want to talk about money. I mean, but records don't cost, you can't charge the same as you used to.
Yeah.
The budget's just not there. So we were going to do the most streamlined budget as possible. And I probably got turned down by 40 labels.
So what were you said some mid-level labels wanted to sign you. Which can you name some of those?
You were talking to like Sumerian and stuff like that.
Okay. I don't really know those labels. So
yeah. Well, there's no rock and roll labels, honestly.
Right.
So we were just talking, you know, we were talking to labels like Epitaph and things like that. They didn't want it.
They wouldn't have a big budget anyway, probably.
I mean, I think they have those emo bands that are pretty big. So,
okay.
So, and then we sent the demos to Alan Kovac. My manager knew him because my manager used to manage John Corabi back in the 90s. Uh-huh. And Alan Kovac manages Motley Crue, and they went through a lawsuit against each other. That's how they know each other. Uh-huh. But I guess he was friendly enough. And Alan Kovac called me and tried to put me on retainer right then and said, we've been looking for an artist like this. You got great songs. Huh. They hit all the algorithms. Let's do a record.
They hit all the algorithms. What does that mean?
That means everybody nowadays runs your songs through an AI algorithm program.
What the fuck?
I'm telling you. To see if it's going to react on digital streaming platforms.
Wow. That is insane, man.
Yeah, they run like any new band you can think of that are kind of above the underground and big stuff like that, that are getting pushes, they're byproducts of algorithms.
So your music passed the algorithms.
And the reason why I think they passed is because I write in single form.
So wait a minute. The music did well with their algorithms or did not do well?
It hit, dude. It killed with the algorithms.
Okay.
And you do tempo, chord change, melodic structure, all this stuff, and that's what they determine. Now, I heard stories from people who older than me that they said like in the 90s and 80s and things, they would call radios, like radio stations would call people and they would listen to them, to the songs, and tell me if they liked them or not.
Yeah.
Always been doing testing, but now they have to hit algorithms. It's like how fast you get to the chorus. Is there a melody here? Well, apparently a lot of the songs I were writing that I did on this record just smashed the fuck out of the algorithms. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So that worked in my favor.
Wow.
But I didn't know anything about it. I was just writing tunes.
So did Alan Kovac, did he end up signing you?
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like you could game the system if you could figure out how to do the algorithms.
I did. I cracked it.
Huh. So you knew the algorithms already before you brought them to the guy?
No, I didn't know they existed.
It was an accident. You accidentally beat all the algorithms.
I guess, like, naturally, I hit them.
All right, so friends, anybody who's listening...
I found out about the algorithms afterwards.
So anybody who's listening to the show right now and trying to get a record deal, listen to Tuck Smith and the Reckless Hearts' new album. And
I didn't know what the algorithms were till afterwards. It was intuitive. Fucking
crazy, man.
It was intuitive.
Oh, so he signed you.
Yeah, but I didn't. I still tried to shop for a while because, you know, Better Noise wasn't. It didn't have. It has Motley Crue. But it has a lot of active rock bands that I'm nothing like
at all. Yeah,
and so I was very, very, very weary about signing. So I made sure they were going to let me have creative control.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you
artwork.
You needed to make sure you had creative control.
Yeah, that was my stipulation.
Right.
Before we signed and made the record.
I would imagine they wouldn't care as long as you hit the algorithms.
Well, dude, I was just worried about, you know, like promotional materials. Yeah. I need to make sure it looks like how I want it to look.
You wanted to have the album and the videos and stuff look the way you wanted them to look.
I produce my videos and do all the artwork. I like attention to detail, and I was worried they were going to come in and try to I had all these inhibitions I didn't know. I mean, I thought, Rob, we're going to make the record, and it might turn into something I didn't want it to either. I was really worried, and I was wrong. But – yeah, so, you know, after a lot of negotiation, we came to an agreement. And then, really quickly, I went to the studio with Cavallo, into one of the biggest, best studios in the fucking world that most people don't get to go into. Truly blessed.
In L.A. or New York or where?
L.A., yeah. Sphere Studios. Linda Perry used to own it.
Okay.
And so I had some of the best session players. Me and Rob handpicked all the people to play on.
Oh, so the record has session guys on it.
Yep, me and Rob handpicked it. It has Vinny Caiuta on drums.
Oh, wow. From
the best drummer in the world.
Wait, Vinny Caiuta. Who is he with?
Dude, he's worked with everybody.
Wasn't he with Frank Zappa?
Yes.
He was on Joe's Garage, right?
Yeah, dude. He's won Modern Drummer 18 times.
Yeah.
He's like,
I remember the song with Dale Bosley, Vinny Caliuta, on the Joe's Garage song. Catholic Girls.
Yeah. Yep. Huh. So Vinny played drums.
Wow.
Yep. And my buddy Tim Pierce, who's played with everybody and played for Rick Springfield. I made him sign my Rick Springfield 7-inch.
And what's he play?
He played guitar with Ricky and me. And Chris Chaney on bass, which plays with fucking Jane's Addiction everybody. And then Jamie Marabak on keys, because I wanted a lot of keys and stuff. And Ricky, I didn't have a band, but I knew that I wanted Ricky to play with me, a guitar player.
So he did play guitar parts on the record.
Yeah, so I flew Ricky out. I said, Ricky, I don't think he knew what was going on. I said, hey, man, I'm doing a record with Rob Cavallo. Are you going to play guitar? He's like, yeah, I'm in. But I don't think he really knew how serious I was.
He just said, yeah, I'm in. He didn't realize the power of the cred of Rob Cavallo.
I don't know. I don't think so. And I think he thought I was kind of bullshit. Like, Tuck's over here saying he's going to do this.
Right, yeah.
Because I don't really talk about, you know, I don't really talk about stuff like that. I just kind of do it. Yeah. And the next thing you know, I said, here's your itinerary. And he said the first day he showed up, he goes, this is real. And the first day of recording, they pitted Ricky and Tim Pierce together in the studio, and Ricky got his ass handed to him.
Huh.
So he was super upset, and we had a talk that night, and he came back the next day to the studio, and he showed his ass and fucking ruled.
Huh.
And just, it was so awesome to see it. And him and Tim Pierce, now I can play guitar, and I've been playing for a while, but watching Ricky and this other guy play.
Yeah, Ricky's dueling, a solo, plays solos, and the other guy, Tim Smith. I don't know him, but he's, I would imagine.
Tim Pierce. They play dueling harmony solos live.
A la Thin Lizzy.
With a track, dude, Boston, Thin Lizzy, anybody. Dude, it was fucking amazing.
Wow. Man, that's a fucking great story. Have you told anybody that story before?
Nobody's heard any of it.
Wow. No. That's a great story, really. So you got signed.
I mean, we can do part two next time if you want to. I don't give a fuck.
Well, let's go a couple more minutes if you don't mind.
Yeah,
so you got signed to Motley Crue's label, or Alan, Motley Crue's manager's label. Is that how you got on the stadium tour?
Well, all they can do is recommend me. So I'm on the stadium tour because Def Leppard and Motley Crue liked my record and signed off on it.
Okay, so you didn't have to do a buy-in, because there's something called a buy-in. You know,
I've never bought onto a tour in my life. I would never do that.
Okay, that's good.
I would never do that.
And so is that tour still on?
It's not canceled. It hasn't even been postponed officially. I'm assuming it's going to get pushed back a little bit, but it's one of the biggest tours of the last decade, and there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars all in. So it's going to be the last thing they probably cancel. I'm thinking in July it's going to happen instead of June.
Well, let's hope that we're allowed to go to concerts after July.
Yeah, well, I mean, Georgia's reopening Friday, so.
Not full on concerts, being able to play gigs and stuff.
No, but like all these places are opening. They're opening the economy back up in three tiers. So like, it's crazy. Tattoo shops are opened and hair salons and bowling alleys. It's really weird, man.
Well, hopefully it gets back together. So are you a Motley Crue fan?
When I was in the heart attacks and I was really hitting it hard on the partying, yes, huge.
Because you know Motley Crue, well, if you do that tour, you'll be able to see firsthand how they do their backing tracks, probably.
Yep. Something I've never done.
You're not going to do backing tracks, right?
I don't even know how to do that.
Good, good. Don't. Please don't. Because Motley Crue uses a lot of backing tracks.
You know what? If I didn't get what I was needing from my band, I needed auxiliary, and I was at that level, I would just hire, like, I saw Aerosmith really close one time with Cheap Trick, and I could see behind the stage, and they had a bunch of auxiliary players back there.
Well, I know that, Aerosmith has that one guy on keyboards. Do they have some other people behind the stage, too?
Yeah, they had guys playing acoustic and singing, but that's normal. Because if you do a record that has a lot of layers and you want to compete, you're going to need...
Yeah. Well, I know that Fleetwood Mac does that. That's better than backing tracks, at least.
Yeah, so I've never had backing tracks, but like, what if you use... I'm deliberating. I haven't done this. But like, what if you had like a keyboard backing track or a hand clap backing track, like something that wasn't even on stage? I mean, it feels weird, but like, I feel like if that was around in the 60s and 70s, they would have done that.
Well, I hope you don't do it. I mean, you do what you want.
I've never done it. So.
All right, I want to talk about Cheap Trick. I remember seeing on your Instagram or Facebook or something, you got on stage and played Surrender. A lot of times they'll have guys, you know, come on stage and play Surrender. That's the go-to song that they bring people up.
I asked to play that one, by the way. It's my favorite song.
So how'd you get backstage? Were they on the same, because they were on what was the label they were on?
Big Machine?
Big Machine, yeah.
Well, my wife is from Rockford.
Oh, okay. All right.
And she knows Dax, and my mother-in-law knows those people.
So you got to go backstage and meet them.
No. They just grew up kind of knowing them, right? Uh-huh. So I know that Biters had opened for Cheap Trick.
I didn't know
that. At the Buckhead Theater in Atlanta. Yeah, 2013 or 14. So that's where I met them. And my aunt blew up at Soundcheck, and Rick let me plug into his whole wall of Marshalls.
Awesome.
So that's how he knew me. And then I think he knew that my wife is from Rockford and kind of knew that. But that day particularly, I was hired by Orange Amps to interview him and do a Rick rundown.
Oh.
So
Did that ever come out?
Yeah, it's online.
Oh, I got to look for that.
So we're talking about his Orange Amps. And he goes, what are you doing here? And I'm like, dude, what's up? I'm here to interview. And he's like, cool. So we're interviewing, and there was a Cheap Trick cover band that followed Cheap Trick around, and it was before Doors, and Rick's out on the stage of the amphitheater with me interviewing him, and these fans come up. They're like, hey, Rick. He's like, how you guys doing? And he goes, after they leave, he goes, they're in a Cheap Trick cover band. They're actually better than us. I probably need them on stage. And I said, Rick, if you ever need somebody that's cute to come on stage and help you fill out some of those guitar parts, I'm your man. He goes, okay, cool. You're coming up tonight. And he hollers back to his guitar tech and goes, Joe, after we do this, fit him for a guitar. He's going to come up with us tonight.
Oh, that's great. I'll bet you were shitting your pants.
I was more nerd. You talk about there's nothing.
Oh, that's a dream to get on stage with
Cheap Trick. My dream.
Does he play Orange Amps?
Yeah, a combo of Orange and Marshall combos.
I got media access to a rock and roll fantasy camp a long time ago, and Cheap Trick was one of the people. Cheap Trick was at the fantasy camp doing their thing, and I remember I went each guy in the band did a what do you call it, a session. You know, they did a clinic, and I went to the Rick Nielsen clinic, and he talked about how his, everything goes through this little box. Did he talk about that?
What do you mean, like little box?
There's a box behind. He had a wall of dummy amps. At least this was back when I did this about 15 years ago. There was a wall of dummy.
Oh, it's probably different now.
And there was a box that he that the microphone would get shoved in the box, and so yeah, he had a rack of amps, and then the speaker was this little box, and so the microphone went in there, so it would be the same sound every venue that they played.
Oh, for consistency, they probably do something like. There's no telling like what they do behind the scenes on that, but I mean he doesn't really use the half stacks. It was a lot of combos and a lot of vintage orange stuff.
So you already knew Surrender, obviously. That's what. So you said, "Can I play Surrender?" And they said, "Okay."
It's my favorite song, like period, of all time.
Yeah. What's your favorite Cheap Trick album?
I don't have a I think pound for pound, my favorite all as an album is Dream Police. But you can understand, I love all the first four or five albums.
I saw them. They did. This was when they had the Red Ant album. You remember the Red Ant, the self-titled Red Ant album?
When was that? What year was that?
Maybe 15 years ago, something like that.
I can't remember.
Anyway, they put out an album for Red Ant. It was self-titled. That one and Special
One. Oh, that one was good. That was good.
You go listen to that album again and Special One. Those are great. Anyway, I saw them. They did three nights in San Francisco, and they did the first album the first night, second album second night, third album third night. It was fantastic.
Wow. I mean, you got it like Heaven Tonight, In Black and White, all that stuff is it's all my favorite. But if I think about like album wise, when you like as a full record, I think Dream Police, but I don't know, man.
Yeah, most people think Dream Police is their best. I saw them in 77 opening up for Foreigner. Heart might have been on the bill too. And that was in Color Tour. So that's why it's my favorite, because that's when I grew up was watching in
that, Color. I can't really have a favorite. When they say what's your favorite, I say first four or five albums. Yeah. So I just, you know.
Well, Tuck, this was quite a lot better of a conversation than I was expecting it to be.
Really? Okay. I feel like I just blabbed for a fucking hour and 30 minutes.
Well, I don't know if anybody's interested, but I certainly was. So that's all that matters.
Okay, good. Okay. Well,
So the new album, you put out the EP or the three songs. When is the new album's completely done, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, it's been done for like a year. So.
Are you waiting for the stadium tour for that to come out?
It was going to be released like right at the beginning of the stadium tour, but now it's on, everything is on hold. Everything. So I don't know when it's going to come out. It's got to come out, you know, the best place for it to come out is during a tour. So it's probably going to get pushed back, which sucks, but there's nothing I can really do.
Have we heard the best songs on the album?
No.
All right. Which song? So, any songs that you had co-writers on the new album on the full length?
Yeah.
Glitter in the Greed sounds like a Butch Walker tune. I don't have the credits.
No. We didn't write that. No.
Okay. He wrote one on the album or no?
Well, we co-wrote. So.
So he co-wrote one on the album with you, or how many on? Who co-wrote the songs that made it to the record? How many? Which songs have co-writers?
Like What Kind of Love is 100% me. Looking for Love, Ready for War is one of the first songs I wrote. The Glitter and the Greed, me and Keith Nelson wrote.
Okay.
I think the next single, Same Old You, that's what me and Butch wrote. And, you know, I like the writers that I want to go to are like people that I like. Uh-huh. And it's not just like random folks. You know what I mean?
How many songs on the album?
I recorded 13, and there's 11 on the record, and two will be like bonus.
Can you name all the song titles that are on the album? Track?
I don't fucking remember. Hold on. Let me get my masters.
And were any of these songs going to be on the next Biter's record?
No, I've written everything after.
You don't have to say all the songs. I just thought it might be cool for the Tuck fans to hear some of the titles.
There's glam, there's Americana, there's a country song, there's power pop, there's some soul stuff, there's like two soul ballads. There's a lot of different stuff on here. I was able to flex a little bit more on this because I didn't have that kind of niche audience that Biters. If I try to stray a little bit, I'll just get fucking beat to death.
Yeah, I can imagine they might have even got beat you a little bit if you went too far in the pop direction, the Biters fans.
Yeah, but I've always, but like when Biters were doing Melody for Lovers, like give me a fucking break, man.
No, that was everybody's like, favorite back then.
That was 2010, and it's like, then we got cast into the hard rock thing. And when I was putting out like Stone Cold Love, people were like, what is this? I'm like, I've always done glammy power pop. So it's just really weird.
Yeah. So how many records are you signed to do, or do they have? How many records does Motley Crue's label own?
Two.
Tuck Smith? So they own you for two records.
Yeah, which is what you want. I got no, dude, they're great.
And I mean, you're not going to have to change your name to do a record if everything falls through with them, are you?
Nothing's going to fall through with them because I made sure that when I worked with them, they had enough power to put me on the level that I wanted to be. I mean, I really want to, be playing stadiums and I want to have really, really big records and I want it on my own terms.
Yeah.
And I feel like they let me do a kind of record I want. They didn't come and tell me what songs. They didn't come to the studio. They didn't A&R me. They didn't do any of that shit, man.
And did Earache do all that?
No, but they're a very small indie label.
And they still, and they owned you. In Earache owned you.
I had to. It's the only way I could keep moving.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tuck Smith, I wish you all the luck on the new record.
I appreciate you having me, man.
It was a really fun interview. Now, I was going to play a song at the beginning and the song at the end. Would that be, first of all, would that be okay?
I don't care. Yeah, do what you
want. And second of all, which songs would you like me to play at the beginning and the end?
Well, I don't care. What do you want to play?
All right, you don't care. So I'll play, how about if I play a Tuck Smith song, one of the three songs from the solo record, and maybe an old Biters tune. Would that be
That's
okay?
That's cool. All right, whatever you want.
All right, Tuck Smith, I really appreciate you doing this. It was a lot of fun.
Hey, man, I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Thanks.
All right, buddy.
All right, bye. Man. There you go. Tuck Smith. Tuck Smith and the Restless Hearts. I'm happy with that. I thought it was pretty good. I heard some good stories. Thank you, Tuck Smith, for doing this. Friends, if you like this interview, I hope you will consider that it's a value for value. And if you got any value out of this, please donate to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. And if you like the interview, go to Tuck Smith on his Instagram or Facebook. Let him know you heard him on the Rock and Roll Geek Show so he didn't think he wasted 1 hour and 28 minutes talking to an idiot up in the mountains. All right. Thank you for listening, friends. I'm going to close out with a song from Tuck's new record, this song is called The Glitter and the Greed. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Just to the riches, that's how it goes when you're down from the ditches. Wanna leave.
It's a rock and roll geek train wreck.